You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome back to The Writer's Block. This is another wonderful promotion of the LA Talk Radio. I am your host, Jim Christina, and I am looking at my co-host, the lovely, charming, vivacious, ever-present Bobby Jean Bell. Hello, Bobby.
Hello, Jim. And I know our listeners can't see, but we're on Skype, so we can all see each other. And this week I have an image of St. Helena Island behind me, just for tonight's guest. Isn't that fun? Probably the closest I'll ever get to it.
I'm somewhat trepidatious. I've got to have some carpal tunnel surgery on Tuesday.
Oh.
And then I have to go in for an ENT exam on Wednesday.
Oh.
As you can probably tell, my nose is clogged always now since I came out of the hospital last year. It's just been never ending. So I think they're going to fix it finally, hopefully. At any rate, I'm going to get right into the show because we have a guest tonight that is phenomenal. She is, not only is she a world traveler, she's a retired businesswoman. She picked up a copy of a book written by a very famous man, Napoleon Bonaparte. And, he never finished it, or if he did, it didn't do a very good job. And she swore to God that she was going to finish it for him. Well, she did. And if you ever wanted to know where Napoleon was, we now know where Napoleon is, because that's the name of her book, Finding Napoleon. And please welcome to the Writer's Block. I mean, really, truly, it's just wonderful to have her here. And her name is Margaret. And please welcome Margaret to the Writer's Block. Miss Rodenberg, how are you?
I'm just fine. Thank you very much for having me here.
Oh my gosh, it's actually an honor for us to have you here. As hard as the bookie worked to get you on the show, I'm glad you're here. This book, we talked the other night, and I said, God, this book is really hard to read. And you said, forget the history, just read it for the story. So I said, okay, I can do that. And I did that, and it made a lot more sense.
Good. I'm sorry to hear you thought it was hard to read. That's something I don't know I've ever heard anybody say about it, honestly.
Well, it's not hard to read. It is just, it has so many twists and turns and so many people jumping in, jumping out. And, it's the French mentality to start with. So, I mean, I don't get the French mentality ever, never have. But I really like the story, and I'm going to read this to you because this is one of your opening lines in the prologue. I warn you, some of this is hearsay from people with tarnished reputations. Much came from the great man's lips when his body lay naked at my side. Part is from a novel Napoleon wrote about himself. I add spice to the stew. So know my Napoleon, know me, and I shall love you for it. But what for love matters? It's the holiest, costliest, easiest thing to give. I gave mine freely as Napoleon gave his to me. I was the last woman he loved. Vive l'Empereur. I don't speak French. Albine, Countess de Montholon. Is that correct?
Montalon.
Okay. what a great passage. She's virtually giving you pretty much the story in two paragraphs. And I really, it's just that she's quite a character to start with. She's got like everything she ever wanted, but then she wants more. And
well, she wants to be sure she keeps
she
it.
She is nothing but intrigued, this woman. She is like, I mean, who do I, you know, I don't know. It's just like, she's just, wow, she's everywhere. But what a great story. What a good story. And it's, thank you so much for putting it to paper. Was it difficult translating Napoleon's original writings to this book?
No, not really. So the manuscripts that Napoleon left behind, and he wrote this manuscript when he was about 26 years old.
Right.
So it was before he knew Josephine, right before he knew Josephine. It was actually sort of in between a love affair and Josephine. And he was still a pretty young guy and didn't have a lot to do, was sort of poverty stricken at the time. So he wrote this and he wrote about 15 pages, and that's all it is. It's 15 large pages, but it tells a full story arc. And what's hard is not so much translating the words from French. The harder thing is really to read his handwriting, to be true.
Oh, yeah, sure.
But he had terrible handwriting. But I didn't have to do that part because there are people who have transcribed it for me in many cases. So I translated the French, but his writing in French is very simple in many ways, because French was his second language. He originally was Corsican, and he'd learned Corsican, and he spoke Italian when he went to France, was sent to France at 9 years old to military school. So his French is less complicated than many other French documents, which are very conceptual often. So you can know every word in the sentence and not know what it means.
Sure. Well, a lot of his writings still exist, obviously.
Oh.
I mean, there has to be tons of them in historical places everywhere. And it's amazing. I find that his real original last name was Buonaparte, which in Italian is good parts. Now, what parts were good, I couldn't tell you, but I... not knowing the man, I don't know.
Oh, I think we get a lot of learning about his parts.
Well, he certainly used what he had.
Oh, my gosh. What a great story.
He was a man, wasn't he?
Yeah, it's a great story.
We know that... I mean, there's so much we don't know about Napoleon, and there's so little that we do know about Napoleon, and he's not really taught in school anymore. So it's like, you know, catch as catch can. You grab what you can grab if you're interested.
Right.
I found it interesting that he connived and he out-traded the U.S. envoy for the Louisiana Purchase, when they just wanted to buy New Orleans, and he sold them the entire center of the United States for $15 million. I thought that was brilliant.
Well, he needed the money, and after his huge fiasco in Haiti, he was done with the New World. And he had enough problems going on in Europe that he wanted out of it. So, yes, it was good for both parties, because if you can imagine, try to imagine the United States with the middle section still owned by France. It would be a very different country. So in one sense, we should be thanking the Haitians who beat him in Haiti, those troops who beat his crack troops, because they gave us the country that we got in the end.
That's true. Well, he never had a navy. I mean, France never did have a navy that was very good.
No, they had a bad navy, yes.
Well, yeah, they had a navy, but it wasn't, I mean, you know, it was just like, I know they used to buy ships from the Continental Congress. Like the Constitution, and they used to buy ships from those shipyards, but they never got enough of them to really make a difference. So,
Right, it wasn't a strong point. But you'll notice in the book that I bring up the fact that I think it was about 1805 that Fulton, our Robert Fulton of the United States,
brought
to Napoleon the idea of a submarine that he had built that he wanted to sell to Napoleon to use against the British government, the British Navy, which, if Napoleon had taken it, might also have changed the course of the world.
Well, you know, that's the biggest word in the English language is if. You know, if Kennedy hadn't gone to Dallas on the 22nd of November, if.
Yes.
You know, history's written by the winners.
Or as Napoleon says, it's a fable agreed upon.
There you go.
But you know, my book doesn't do much with the middle of his life, all the hard stuff about Napoleonic history. It's really just meant to be the story of him rising up from nowhere into power and what he could have been, what he wished he could have been in the end.
Right.
And then his last years as he's in decline, but having his last love affair and his last battle, though it be more mental than any other way, against the British while he was in exile. So I leave out all the geopolitics, all the wars. I don't care who moved troops where. So it's a different kind of Napoleon story.
Yeah. Yeah, I found it interesting that he just in a bit, Bobby. Yeah. I found it interesting that he preferred to wear the colonel of an artillery officer, the uniform of an artillery officer, instead of the emperor's uniform, which I don't think he had ever designed. Over everything else, he just wore that green tunic and that was his uniform. I mean, I found that amazing. You know, he's a colonel instead of, you know, whatever he was, a president or.
He used emperor's robes, very elaborate emperor's robes, when it was appropriate in Paris for major events. But on a daily basis and for most of the time, he would be dressed as a colonel in the chasseur group of the army.
Right.
And he was a simple guy. He didn't eat fancy food. He didn't drink a lot of wine and champagne. And when he did drink wine and champagne, he watered it down. He didn't really care so much about riches in that way. He cared about them when they were useful, but not for their own sake and not for the purpose of having them.
Well, sure. I mean, he came to power right after the French Revolution. So, I mean, that fomented his coming to power because the country was in such chaos back then. I mean, you know, it was like amazing. Bob, you had a question.
Well, I just wanted to say that it seems that there's several themes that run through this book, and I did really enjoyed it. And one is, and I wish I had written it down, but it has to do with going through life kind of based on your merits. And it's sort of turning the aristocracy upside down and saying you can have a life based on your merits, which is sort of, I think, a new thought, at least at that time in France. And then there's love and betrayal that run rampant through this book. And we're in this last 5 years of his life, and he is examining that life that you just talked about. So even though we're not into specifics on troop movements and things, this is a guy re-examining his life and looking back at both victories and the things that were the challenges. The character of Albin is written in the first person, but we get the story sort of through many different eyes.
Right.
Why did you choose... And Jim read that prologue, which I remember now from the beginning of the book. But why did you choose to use, with one character, only the first person?
So as the book developed, when I first started writing the book, my first conception of what it was going to be, when I said, I absolutely vowed to finish this book of Napoleon's. Originally, I was just going to do that soldier's love story of betrayal, which is what the story Clisson, Clisson, if you can't see it, that I was just going to write that and make that into a full big novel when it's only really about 15 pages, but a whole story arc in that 15 pages. Now he carried those pages with him from the time he was 26 all the way till when he was in St. Helena, when he was 50. So he cared about them, but they weren't even known about by anybody. and they're all scratched up. I actually got to hold some of them in my hands. It was a wonderful experience. But so I started with that idea of doing that. Then as I progressed on that and got to, I said, I can't ghostwrite for Napoleon unless I know him a whole lot better. Mm-hmm. So, and as a person, not just the fact, but as a person. So as I did that, then I decided, well, I'm going to have the older Napoleon in exile look back on his life and write essentially his origin story, or the origin story that he'd like to tell about who he was as a young man.
Sure.
So it became those two stories. And Albine originally was just a character in there. I knew about her as his love affair, but she was just a character without her own point of view. So it was in later revisions that Albine started coming to the front for me more and more. And when I set about giving her her own point of view, I wanted to make it different enough from his point of view. Mm-hmm. And that's why I went for the first person, which happens to be a person. I love to write in the first person. I actually tried to do Napoleon in the first person in the beginning, and that wasn't going anywhere. So I have the first person from Albine and Napoleon's third person, and then intertwined in their story of St. Helena is the writing of Napoleon writing his Clisson novel as he sees himself looking back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's amazing that the scenarios that you picked, and the one that really struck me, I think, more than anything in that book was towards the end when he's on his deathbed. And I forget the gentleman's name, but he was in there and he stopped hearing the heartbeats. And then it dawned on him that was his, that he stopped hearing. His heart stopped because his emperor's heart had stopped and his emperor lay there deceased. And he threw himself over the body. I thought, wow, that's devotion.
Yeah. My young character, Tobison.
Yeah, yes. Tobison.
I don't know if that was true or not, but wow. I mean, if it wasn't true, what a great piece of imaginative writing, because it got to me.
I think Tobison for me was one of the most endearing characters from the book. And we see him, you know, go through several years. He changes, but their relationship is so very, very special. The traitors, I never really thought about that. And I'm sure anybody in politics is very familiar with being aware of all the potential traitors that you may have around you. But this book really brings out that the person closest to you can be trusted a lot of the time, but maybe not all the time. And that he was very savvy. I don't know that I knew that he was such a chess player in that way, that he really could identify and be aware of and actually use somebody he thought maybe could be treacherous in a way that would actually help him.
Uh-huh. I would say that is one of his very real traits, was that he was able to do that. He also was someone who, amazingly for what we think of as a Corsican, was very forgiving of people who betrayed him. And he took them back in many times and put them back into power under him. And often they betrayed him again. And sometimes he forgave them again. Sometimes he didn't. But for example, his great love, Josephine, shortly after they got married, and 2 days later, Napoleon went off to Italy to war. And meanwhile, back in Paris, Josephine began what was most probably, it's always hard to know these exactly, but almost well known that she started having an affair immediately. And he heard about her affairs right away, and he was just, you know, devastated. But he took her back in the end.
Of course.
And that happened several different times.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, keep that thought. Don't go away. And we'll be right back after a real brief word. This is LA Talk Radio. You're listening to The Writer's Block. And we'll be right back with you right after a brief word from LA Talk Radio.
Jim Christina here for LA Talk Radio. And if you've ever thought that you could be a radio host, certainly your opportunity.com. Find the link that says be a host and follow the instructions. You know, everybody's got something to say. And if you've got a show that you think needs to be heard, how about you link up with us? Because we've got 50-minute shows available every day of the week, plus Sundays. So how about giving us a try? That's latalkradio.com. And listen every Thursday, 6 p.m. Pacific, for the Writer's Block. Right here on LA Talk Radio.
And we're back. It is now 6:20. And we are in the studio with Margaret Rodenberg. They're in her book, Finding Napoleon, and of course, Bobby Jean. And if you want to call and talk to Margaret, and if you're interested in Napoleon, this is what you really want to do. The number here in the studio is 323-302-0815. Again, that number is 323-302-0815. Okay, we're back. So, interesting story. I am just absolutely thrilled that we get to talk to you about it. And mostly, the book is really good, but the history of Napoleon fascinates me. And I don't know why. It just does. Well, probably because I was a history major.
Well, and because, you know, Jim, what I was trying to remember, you and I both being sort of more American history and certainly Western history kind of chair historians, in, you know, I was, as she was covering these different parts of what was going on in his life, in his career, I was thinking like, okay, what's happening over here then? And that was what was so interesting about the whole submarine thing. I mean, it felt so like submarine, so contemporary. And I always sort of somehow think of Napoleon as like not in the same time period that he really is. I don't know, right. You know. And that whole part of the fun of this book, too, is the schemes to how he wants to get back to his son, to the eaglet. And all of these ideas about, you know, how he's going to escape from this island and his jailers there and how messages get smuggled. And I was like, wow, this is the intrigue in this. I knew he'd been on Elba and I knew he'd been on St. Helena, but Jim, did you have any idea that, you know, his life was still like, he was still trying to stay in the thick of things?
No. What got me is he gets out of Elba Island, goes back to France, takes over again.
100 days.
And the British immediately kick his ass. And put him back, and once again send him off to exile.
Yeah,
this time
British,
in St. Helena.
And the British are his jailers. Where yeah. I guess I was thinking the French were his jailers for some reason, you know, that they'd thrown him out and so it just opened up so many things for me. And I think that's why it also took me a little bit longer than sometimes to we do read the book. That's one thing Jim said to us 301 shows ago when we started this was we will right. read the book and we're always happy to. But I'm like, oh my gosh, I have so much more to read.
Yeah,
and I think it's because my brain was trying to, I was reading the story, but you were giving us enough of the history that I was pondering it and trying to kind of put it into a historical perspective that I could understand.
Right, right.
Because it's not an area of European history that I'm familiar with.
You have some great scenes in this book, and one of the scenes that really stick to mind, not the one that the guy throws himself on Napoleon's dead body, but it's a gentleman standing there, and he's thanking Napoleon for the roads and for the trees on the side of the road, and for the water and the water feed into his farm. And all the good things that Napoleon has done for France, and his son was killed in Russia, and his wife hates Napoleon, but he says she doesn't understand. Okay, I get that, you know, but what a great little scene. I mean, I think, you know, I thank him for this, and I thank him for this, and my son was killed in Russia, so my wife hates him, but, you know, he did so much good for the country.
But isn't that, you know, that's part of the divisiveness of Napoleon. He's either hated or he's adored, and it's obviously deserves to be both.
Right.
That's part of what makes him interesting and what makes him such a complex character.
Right.
because he did great good and he did great bad. But you know, if you think about that little scene there, now that's a scene out of my imagination.
Okay.
Of that. He's not thanking, he's not doing directly to Napoleon, but to one of Napoleon's acolytes, one of his young friend, Tobison. But do we, when we're in this country, if our son has gone off to war and died, do we then hate our country? Or,
no.
Or you know, so I think it's hard sometimes for us to transfer our feelings about our own country even to greater history, you know, and to
right.
to say, well,
right.
you know, to not pass judgment without looking at ourselves, you know, it's and seeing that the balance that we're not maybe mm-hmm. not living the balance or not putting the balance between the two.
Right. And so
There are some other scenes that really set the landscape or the environment, the smells, the foods, and so forth. The book opens when he's in a ship headed for St. Helena, and I couldn't wait till we got off that ship. I thought, oh, how many more pages we're going to be in this ship? But, you know, you really crafted the experience, which was not an unusual experience for ship travel, you know, at that time. There's another scene where this sort of, I'll say, aristocratic group go out for a midnight picnic in a cathedral, a monastery or church that's no longer in use.
Mm-hmm.
And that's quite an interesting scene. You know, you give us all kinds of introductions to what a workaday and live-a-day world was like.
Right.
That I found very enjoyable and really swept me into the moment. And I enjoyed the richness of that. You know, Albine, you know, Jim, she's always got a crust of bread in her pocket or in the hem of her. And I thought, was that true for Albine, or is that because it's a really neat character trait with her?
That really was just to show the damage done to a person during the kind of time like the French Revolution and the pain that these people went through mm-hmm. in prison during that time and the fear of being killed. So it was really having gone through the chaos. Albine is always afraid she's not going to have enough to eat, mm-hmm. and she's afraid for her physical safety all the time. So she's got, you know, what we today call
PTSD.
PTSD. And that's part of her trait, and you see over time whether or not she can outgrow that and find stability in her life. And that's maybe why I hope why in the end you love Albine regardless of her own faults and where she is treacherous to other people, because she has these endearing flaws and she has reason for why she has motivation really from her life mm-hmm. as to why she's not what we would call totally moral.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that any of them actually are. Maybe Joybison. I see. Jim is asking me a question, so I'm answering.
I'm going to, but let's take another quick break and then we'll come back with it. And you were listening to LA Talk Radio. This, of course, is the Writer's Block. And we shall return right after a brief message from Out West.
Here at the Out West Shop, we're passionate about the American West, the truth and the myth. We're purveyors of fine Western goods. We scout for unique and distinctive apparel, accessories, home decor, and general merchandise that are a reflection of the Western lifestyle. We hunt for unique artisans and craftsmen who are inspired to create decorative art you can wear based on their own love for the story of the West. We round it up and bring it to you. Check out OutWestShop.com when you need anything Western.
Wow, that's abrupt, isn't it?
A little bit right at the end. Can I just make a comment, though? That's
Absolutely.
Our business, OutWestShop. And one of the things, Margaret, is on our website, we have a link to bookshop.org. And I was so excited to see that your book, which just published on Tuesday, is already there. And on your website, you have a link to bookshop.org. I posted the book on our affiliate website. It's right there under featured books and also under the writer's block. And as soon as this podcast is available, on that book will go a link to the podcast. So I do that in a couple places on our website as well. But that's I was excited to see that you listed bookshop.org as one of the places, because they're just about a year old, little over a year old now. And they've raised over $12 million. I think maybe they're at 13 now. That goes into a fund to support independent booksellers. So I was excited to see that there.
It's so important to support the independent booksellers. And I use I put bookshop.com on everything, because it is a way to let people who want to buy online do it easily. Rather than saying you have to go through your own local bookstore, but it still gives a benefit to the local bookstores. And you can designate which bookstore is going to get the benefit also when you buy. So it's a very important organization. Yeah, very important organization. So I'm 100% for bookstores.
Oh, good. Well, so are we. I mean, brick and mortar is obviously the highlight, but I mean, we don't have those anymore. Not very many anyway. And, now it's go to Amazon or go to bookstore.com or wherever you can get a book. If you're lucky, you get to go to a book signing and buy it there, autographed. But, hey, it is what it is.
When you were writing this and you had a publication date, let's see, COVID year was going on. I mean, we're not out of COVID yet. Absolutely not. But did you, in terms of getting, beginning to think about how you would promote, when did it go to the publisher? How long did the publisher?
It was already at the publisher before COVID was something that was happening. So from the time it started with the publisher, there was still about 18, 19 months before the publication date. So I didn't end up being in the first and second group of springtime and fall authors during COVID time. So there's a lot that was learned during those things. So I was able to, I guess I can say, to stand on the backs of those poor, or the shoulders of those poor people who had to go through that as new authors. So by the time my time came around this spring, much more was known, and we're a little more used to, everybody's more used to doing things, virtually. So I'm going to virtual book fests. I did a virtual book club this morning and a virtual writing group. So you just get used to doing that.
Sure.
Maybe sometime we'll get back to something else.
When you sat down to write this book, after you decided that you're going to finish Napoleon's work, 15 pages is not a lot. And you added, that's like adding another 345 pages to something that was already written.
Well, but to the Clisson story, the Clisson story was about 15 pages. And in my book, it's about 100 pages. So that's that internal story of the young man. Mm-hmm. And it's a love story. And it's, as I said, it's Napoleon's origin story. And it has all the love and betrayal that is throughout the whole book.
Right.
So that's that portion of it. But yes, you start a novel from scratch. You know that, Jim. You start the page and you start typing, right?
Well, it was interesting that Napoleon, as he's working on the story during the book, Betsy, she was charming. Betsy and then later Alvin actually kind of work with him on it. And then Alvin puts it in her own handwriting so that she'll be able to smuggle it out, which was very, you know, the whole thing about, it's not just the story, but it's also the other people that were involved with him on getting that story out. It was interesting how you did that.
Right. And not all of those things, some of those things you're talking about are actually historical, and some of them are part of the story, finding the interesting parts in between that could make sense, could have happened, drawing the lines where there are kind of mysterious connections that you can make something out of. That's that's writing historical fiction, right? And then if you, at the end of the book, there's an author's note that gives you a really full accounting of what is known history and what is Margaret Rodenberg's imagination, or imagination that other people have discerned as saying this is what happened to Napoleon, whether or not it's actually true.
Sure.
You know, such as whether or not he died, and I don't want to give everything away in the book, but whether or not he died of something is still something that is not known one way or the other.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll buy that.
Yeah.
Of course, I'm known to buy just about anything, so hey. How long did it take you to write this, Margaret?
Well, depends on where you say I started, because when I first decided I was going to write it is almost 20 years ago, when I first read about the book Clisson. Napoleon called Clisson and Eugénie. But at that point, I didn't know how to write anything. I'd never written fiction. I'd always wanted to, and I'd always planned to write a novel. So I set about learning how to write first. And I spent some time on that. I even wrote a different novel first, one that never sold. I had an agent who never was able to place it. I still love that book. I'll still go back to it, and I've rewritten it probably three times. But it took me, so when I actually sat down and started Napoleon seriously was really 2011, when I started deep research. And probably 2012, when I really started getting more and more of the novel written. And the first time, so I'd say 2013 is where I had a first good, solid writing effort that later got revised many times.
Gotcha. Well, they usually are, you know, and then you get editors sticking their fingers in and, you know, a lot of people don't understand it. And we gear this show towards new writers. And a lot of new writers don't understand the idea behind research, and they don't understand how to research, and they don't understand how long research actually can take. Jonah Blue is a good example. I did a lot of research on the mountain man, and a lot of people didn't even know they were called Rocky Mountain Free Trappers. They just thought mountain men. Well, they were called the Rocky Mountain Free Trappers, and they became, of course, the Mountain Men, and they disappeared in 1840. So they only had like a 20-year run or 30-year run. That was it. But there are things that they did. The research that has to go into the things that they made and things that they did, and much like Napoleon and you know, how they dressed, how they ate, how they talked even. Is an incredible amount of research before you even start writing a book.
Right.
So and if you're a new writer out there and you are listening to Margaret, bear in mind that the research takes sometimes up to 2 or 3 years before you ever put any words onto paper. And right. So it's incredibly time consuming. And thank God for the internet, because you can do a lot of it on the internet.
Mm. But it also can be a trap. Where you can't.
It can be. Because you click here, click there, and all of a sudden you're someplace you don't even want to be.
If you're somebody who loves history, you might want to just keep going on and on with the research.
I know, huh?
You also have to be careful you don't overfeed it to your readers, that what you do use helps advance the story rather than just being an information dump about about something. So it's I love the research also, and the truth is that in terms of learning who Napoleon was, because really for most of us he really is still a stick figure, and that was part of my effort. Was I wanted to flesh him out for me so that I could understand him and write from his point of view, but also to present him as a fully rounded person, to my readers. And that took a lot more than 3 years. You know, that took a lot of other.
You know, I mean, you present us in this book, Finding Napoleon, with a very well-rounded character. You've actually managed to flesh him out to the point where he's no longer a stick figure. Yeah. How much is true, how much isn't, nobody will ever know, because nobody was there to write the dialogue down, and nobody was there to write the thoughts down, and nobody was there, you know, so we always have to guess, you know, what the dialogue is. And your dialogue, incidentally, is really good. I really like your dialogue.
Thank you.
I love writing dialogue, and so when I see good dialogue, I really like it a lot, you know. That's why I said Moon is one of my favorite people. Moon Crow. But you've given us a story that is not so easy to read until you drop the historical part and just read it for the story. You're absolutely right, because then it becomes a love story.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you don't really realize that when you're into the book. You don't really realize that as you're trying to struggle your way through all the historical stuff. And you go, and then you say, well, just forget all that. Just read it as a story. Okay, I can do that. And then it becomes, then it just becomes a love story between two people. Just sometimes three. Just depends on who was there at the time.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
You have a great website.
You do.
I spent some time when I should have been reading, but I went to your website, and then I was just pulled in. And you had a trip to St. Helena back in 2011. That's another thing that told me, oh, she's been working on this a long time. That was a wonderful video. That video, and then the one that's all the images of Napoleon's, I think it's just such music. And kind of fades in and out with paintings and sculptures. And I thought that was fascinating. Tell us just a little tiny bit about that trip to St. Helena and what that did for you in your research, maybe.
Sure. Okay, so I've been doing a lot of research on Napoleon, and I was coming to the point where, and I was starting to try to put things down on paper. And the hard thing, and as I told you, I'd started to even try to write from his point of view in first person.
Sure.
And none of it was quite working. And I decided, one day I was sitting here and I just said, I got to go to St. Helena. And and somehow I convinced my husband to go to St. Helena too. What that took was, at that time, St. Helena, and you have to understand, it's in the middle of the South Atlantic Ocean. Midway between Africa and South America. So there's nothing around at all, right? 1,200 miles off the coast of Africa. At the time I went there, there wasn't even an airport at all, and never had been. So at about 4,000 people live there. It's still a British colony, or territory, they call it, excuse me. Since then, they've put an airport in at 2018. It really was finished. But the only way to get there was to fly to South Africa, to Cape Town, and get on what was one of the last of the British true mail ships, the kind of ships that used to go around to all of their colonies and pick up mail and bring cargo and bring people. And that ship at the time, which was called the HMS St. Helena, was a transport ship with could carry about 60 people, 60 passengers, but all the rest was carrying every single thing that St. Helena might need. So it doesn't matter whether it was a battery, a copy of my book, your meds, you know, your medicine, just anything whatsoever, your tires, just think about your milk, pasteurized milk, anything like that had to come on that ship. And it would come, and it was a 5-day voyage out of Cape Town. So it was quite a commitment to go. And that's why you find very few people, including Napoleonic scholars, who have ever gone to St. Helena. But on the island, there are three sites in particular that are the Napoleon sites. The first place that Napoleon lived, which was the place that he lived where that was owned by the character Betsy's father, that you mentioned, the young girl, charming young girl, who helped him out and was just a friend. So he was there for about 6 weeks. Then there is the house that he lived in for about 5 years called Longwood House. And then there is the place where he was buried, when he died on St. Helena, and where he was stayed there in his grave there for about 20 years into more than 20 years, 30, yeah, 20 years before he was moved back to Paris, before the British would let him be moved back to Paris. So it was an amazing thing, because those places are, the French really take care of them in such a way that they are so evocative of the time and the people that you really feel, particularly if you're an imaginative writer, you really feel the presence and the way in which the people who are living in exile live there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I felt it had to be emotional for you to be there.
It was.
So we were there for 9 days and then 5 days back to Cape Town.
Jeez. We're going to take one more quick break. You're listening to LA Talk Radio. This, of course, is the Writer's Block. And we'll be right back with you right after a brief note from Tuscany Bay Books.
Congratulations, you finally finished that book. Now what are you going to do with it? Well, as a new writer, you probably do what all new writers do, stick it in the drawer with the other six or seven. Well, why not this time do something a little different? Why not get a hold of Black Dog Publishing and our fine imprint of Tuscany Bay Books? See, we can get that book out of the drawer. We can proofread it. We can edit it. We can format it. We can publish it. We can print it. We can copyright it. And we can get it on the shelf so your friends, your neighbors, your relatives, hell, even a person you don't know or two or three might want to buy a copy. It's all what it's about. And all of this for less than the cost of your firstborn. So why not give us a shot? BlackDogPublishing.co, TuscanyBayBooks.com. Your answer to getting your book published, and right now we're probably the best at what we do in this industry. Black Dog Publishing, Tuscany Bay Books.
And we are back, and in the 5 minutes we have left, Margaret, have you ever had writer's block? And if you have, how did you get out of it?
I've never really had what I would call writer's block, that I wasn't able to just jump into some other kind of writing about the subject, or jump over to research, or switch points of view, write about a different character or a different part of the book. So honestly, I find that if you're just nimble on your feet enough, or go for a long walk, mm-hmm. and come back. That's
okay.
That's
that'll work.
How about you, Jim? Have you ever had writer's block?
Yes. Well, I call it writer's pause. I did. I've had it a few times, and I found that when I wind up in that situation where it just isn't coming, I'll think of a scene that is going to be inserted later on in the book, and I'll go ahead and write that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and
that's what I say too.
Save that, and then when it comes to the point where it needs to be, I cut it, paste it, and put it in the book, and I've already done. So, I mean, I kind of like take care of it that way. But not always, and you know, it's sometimes hard to sit down and just go, wait a minute. It was either too much bourbon, too many martinis, or not enough coffee this morning, but it just isn't coming. You know what I mean? So yeah, I think we've all had it to a degree. It's just depending on how you take care of it when it happens. But I'm like you. I'll write something different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know? And really that was one reason I went to St. Helena, was to get that inspiration. And the other place I got the inspiration, I felt, was when I got to hold Napoleon's real pieces of paper that he wrote on.
Oh my God, that had to have been so
exciting.
It was in private hands in Santa Barbara, California. And it was just a really amazing experience to have.
Santa Barbara.
In Santa Barbara. Wow. That is really interesting. Yeah. So what are you working on next?
So I'm working on a French Revolution novel that takes the French Revolution and thinks of it in the way that we write dystopian novels today, because it truly was a dystopian time.
Oh, absolutely.
And it looks at it also maybe a little bit from the point of view of social justice. So I'm kind of looking at, how does the French Revolution even compare to us today if we slipped out of mm-hmm. off off our off our tracks, which is what they did. If you compare the French Revolution to the American Revolution,
right,
happened at the same time, very much.
Right.
Such different results.
Right.
Fascinating.
You know, there's one of my favorite quotes from that time period was Lafayette, when he came back, and he was a viscount, and they asked him if he would like to run for the governor of his where he lived in the territory of France, and he said no. He says I have no wish to govern people who have no wish to be governed. And I thought, how astute of a man, having just come back from the American Revolution and seen the difference between himself and his French brethren. You know what? It's been a real treat having you, Margaret. It's just, this hour has just flown by. And it's just always great when you know we got a great guest when we look at the clock and it says, holy crap, we're out of time.
Well, I've loved talking to the two of you, and I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about my book anytime.
Well, that's our writers. That's what we all do. That's what the premise of the show was. Writers love to talk about themselves.
That's right.
And about what they've written. So why not give them the forum to do it?
And I appreciate that. So I'll just mention my title one last time.
Please do.
Finding Margaret.
And it is available on Amazon and all the online booksellers. Mm-hmm. And available through your website.
Through my website, through your local bookstore. If you go in, I'm sure they can get it for you if they don't have it in stock also.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And your website is margaretrodenberg.com.
Yes. Or you can use it by going to findingnapoleon.com.
Either
one works. Be the same website.
Oh, excellent. And you know what? It's been an honor having you with us. And I love historians because they have so many great stories.
Well, we know it just published on Tuesday, so congratulations. You are off and running, and we look forward to seeing it hit bestseller lists and see where else you're going to be interviewed. And what a important time in your life, the birth of this book this week. So congratulations on that.
What's your name?
Bobby Jean?
Doesn't matter.
We both feel that you will be at the top of the New York Times bestseller list.
Well, we want to see that.
I'd like to see that. So if anything you could do to make that happen, I would be appreciated.
Well, now you have about 250,000 people listening to you live right now.
Oh,
great. And another 400 and some odd thousand will pick up the podcast in the next 3 or 4 days. So this show is very popular in the writing community. We're probably the most popular. There are other writers' blocks, but we're the only one that goes out live. Mm-hmm. Live radio. That's why I told you this is stuff happens and does all the time. So you never know.
I really thank you very, very much for.
We thank you for joining us, and I know it's getting late there, so we will say good night. But thank you again for joining us. It was a hoot.
Thank you. Enjoy this time. Thank you.
That's very generous of you to say.
Enjoy it. Thanks, Margaret. Okay.
Take care.
Okay, you too. Next week, we have a returning guest, Christine Raymond, will be with us. And, of course, next week is a Russ week. The last time she was on,
the third Thursday.
I know. Well, that's because last week was the first. Yeah. Last time we had her on, it was October of 2019, and we talked about her book. I don't even remember now. One of those play on words. At any rate, talking about that or something else next week. So it'll be fun, and always great to see you, Bobby Jean.
Great to be here.
Always, but it's a pleasure. And 3 years or 6 years is coming up.
I know. I can't believe it.
I know, next month.
May, I can't believe it.
I know, wow. And we're almost halfway through the year.
I know.
What happened? So.
It just marches on.
For Bobby Jean and Jim Bell and Russ Avison and, of course, Ronan Rosner, myself, Jim Christina, and, of course, the man who makes it all happen, Mr. Sam Hassan in LA Talk Radio, we are out of here.